Perfect. And I think for those of us interested in disrupting the determinism in the sciences, the new developments in epigenetics, and the ways in which scientists themselves are disrupting determinism are very exciting. So maybe a lunch conversation. I think we had a question over here.
I'm Martin Krieger at the University of Southern California. I don't know what this determinism has to do with science, but I'll leave that to you. And it's not about quantum mechanics that I'm talking. I don't know. Nonsense. If you want an ethical example, the design of Auschwitz was done by engineers, all right? And there's a great book which goes into the archives of, the archives of the German manufacturing companies where the design issues came up. But more to the point. First of all, about 30 years ago, I was teaching undergraduates at MIT, and I was going to say, this was on my mind since yesterday, that the humanists should be absolutely delighted to have MIT or any engineering undergraduates. They're usually quite bright. They usually come with a certain set of background, usually calculus, engineering, so forth. So you have some analogies you can use for free. I'm trained as a physicist, so it was easy for me, but I was teaching humanities. So they have a certain culture. And that you just have to figure out how to plug into it. But once you plug into it, you own them. Because then you're not giving them culture, you're not stuffing them down their throats. The analogies are palpable. The distinction, so I think that's the most important thing I want to say to my humanities colleagues. You're fortunate to have these students. I teach at the University of Southern California, so I get a very wide range of them, and you're fortunate to have the engineering students. The second point, all the professions I know of talk about the distance between what you do in the university and what goes on in actual practice. Law, to some extent medicine, certainly in city planning, so we don't get any special credit in engineering. And then I was irritated yesterday when someone talked about the linearity of science versus the something else of the humanities. I don't know any linearity in science. Maybe you know, but I don't. I've never seen it. And you talk about the double consciousness that you need. I don't know humanists who have any double consciousness.
I'm sorry?
I don't know humanists who have double consciousness. Arrogance is their mode, in my experience. Usually even their self-criticism is arrogant because it's a certain kind of internal criticism. They don't have a sense of themselves. No, I know you don't agree. I'm not worried about that. I'm just talking about my experience in reading the literature over 40, 50 years.
I think this is also an interesting, informative experience for those of us in the humanities and social sciences.
What?
I'm saying that this is also an experience for those of us in the humanities and social sciences.
That what?
Yes. Well, you're talking about your experience, and now I'm talking about my experience of being told that I'm arrogant. And this, right, the question of this panel, how do we feel about participating in
I wasn't talking about you. I was thinking generically. I mean, you're wonderful, I'm sure. And I don't care, actually. But the point about it is that this double consciousness talk, or that's some other language, code switching, I have found code switching totally incapable of 99% of my people in humanities and social sciences. The one thing we've left out here, which is interesting, is the economists. And I don't want to say a lot more other than I don't even know what to do with them, actually. But, they tend to, claim the largest salaries and the largest influence. But just to go back, you're privileged to have these students because they come with a fixed culture. If you can plug into it, you own them. That's the secret. And plugging it is not a distortion of Plato or whatever you want to teach them. You just have to give it to them. And once you got them, they may not be interested fundamentally, but no longer can they teach whatever courses you're teaching treated as something outside their realm.
Great. Thank you very much.
Can I just say really quickly, yes. I don't think I didn't hear myself or any of my colleagues complaining about our students. I actually love my MIT students.
No, I didn't say you were
complaining. I just wanted to clarify that, and also to say that the closest I came to complaining about anybody was actually economists.
I'm sure we actually all have a lot to say in this particular conversation, but we have a limited amount of time, and so I want to hear from actually the three people who are standing up, and then if we have time coming up till 10:30, perhaps we can continue any of the points of that conversation. So I think you are next.
I don't know how close do I have to get. Oh, closer than I thought. Robin Adams from Purdue. I just wanted to say I really appreciated, maybe I'm seeing a move from yesterday that got a little bit stronger right now, of this focus on thinking and mindsets. You know, when we're talking about liberal education, I've been hearing a lot of content and a lot of pedagogy, but I haven't actually heard learning or learning theories or ways to think about that. And I also really appreciated sort of, again, what I think is, for me, I think one of the greatest opportunities in this space is the similarities and differences type of thing. Mm-hmm. And so my work focuses on design thinking and cross-disciplinary thinking and what those similarities and differences provide. Is they provide these opportunities for people to critically reflect, become aware of their own beliefs or values that shape what they do, call them into question, challenge them, try them out on other people, potentially reshape them, and they become more inclusive. So I just wanted to sort of bring that and perhaps see what kinds of experiences you've had that maybe you've seen those types of things, and how can that be a part of what it means to shape a liberal engineering education or whatever it is we want to call it. Mm-hmm. Like, where is the learning and how can we talk about the learning and in what ways is it transformative? And the nice thing about that, it also brings in identity. So I'll just throw that out there.
Okay, so maybe one response and then we'll hear from the other questioners.
So I'm lucky enough to teach at a school that has a particular sort of very long historical identity. And so that's part of the package, which not all the students appreciate, but I try and teach them to say, well, pretend, you know. But to use as part of their set of metrics for figuring out who's the we that's designing this thing, to think not just synchronically in 2015 what community am I a part of, but also throughout the past, you know, 1,000 years or 2,000 years or something like that.
Great. Good. So I think one question there and then over here.
Diane Michael Felder from McAllister. I'm not sure how well-shaped my question is because I got here after the coffee had run out, but I'll do my best. Anne mentioned the word rhetoric once, I think, so I'll mention it again. I was interested in the number of times that all of you had used the word offer. And it seems that when in talking about what liberal studies or liberal arts broadly construed, that seems to be the verb that has been operationalized here, offer. We can offer skills. Those in liberal arts can offer the big questions you mentioned that keep people up at night. Another thing that can be offered, and more than one person has said this, is context. That seems to me very one-way streetish. And I'm just curious if you could maybe comment on what holistic education in engineering or holistic engineering could offer to the liberal arts colleagues here. Mm-hmm. What is in it for us? I think that there is something very much in it for us, tamping down arrogance aside.
Good. And so maybe one response from the panel and then a next question.
In the exchange between students, one thing happens that contributes to the education of the liberal arts student, and that is they see fire in the eyes of the engineering students. For most of the liberal arts students, engineering students are clumped as a bunch of nerds who just look at their hands as they walk across campus. But when the engineering students start talking about what is important to them, they come alive. And suddenly, engineering isn't this obscure, dead, or deafening kind of activity. It's an activity that people are engaged in. And I think that's really important for the liberal arts students to learn, that engineers are people. And they have passion.
I mean, I would just say very quickly before Chris's question, for me, working with engineering students and colleagues has pushed me to be much more specific. I think in some previous moments of my life, I made a lot of arm-waving generalizations. This is always like this. This tends to happen. And when you're grounded within a particular problem-based community, you need to be specific. And so I know it's improved my own thinking and teaching in that way. So, Chris?
Chris Boudreau, WPI. I'm really fascinated, Anders, by your findings. And like Larry, I would encourage you to disseminate them or for us to do more research on this. And I love the idea of a double consciousness because I'm thinking, I don't know where that term began, but I know that Emerson used it before Du Bois did. And he talks about how people have to ride alternately on the horse of their private nature and their public nature. And what he meant by that, I think, is that you learn about your own values, your own desires. That's your private nature, what you really, really want from the world. And then the public nature is when you go out into the world and you find that the world constrains you in ways that your private nature doesn't allow. And so when your students learn about, you know, the hands-on or the or if they're taking progressive pedagogy, if they're undergoing, you know, something that we are, I think, aspiring to, and then they go out in the world and they find that in their jobs the door to all of that is just shut to them, what do they do then? Do they accept that job and say, well, that was my 4 years of dream world, I'll never have that again, they told me these were the best years of my life, now they're over? Or do they try to, do they quit? Do they alternate and try to transform the world? And I think that's our responsibility as teachers, is to talk to them about that while they're there. And I know there's a study I heard about recently out of Northeastern that 19-year-olds were surveyed, and most of them believed that they would be working for themselves. And I have anecdotal evidence from students who've graduated in engineering, and they come back 5 years later and they say, most of my friends in engineering are no longer engineers. And I think, why don't we talk to them about these values? Because whether I'm a humanist teaching engineering students or I'm an engineer, we're human beings and we all have aspirations and values. And whether it's your ethical values, I don't want to design Auschwitz, or whether it's just a kind of quality of life, I don't want to be following someone else's instructions, I have a creative mind. I wish we could, and maybe set up alternative career fairs where we bring in the companies that we know are encouraging the kinds of students that you've educated and that we all want to educate. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. There's a time for one quick response and then the last question, and then a break. So did anybody want to, I thought that was a fantastic point. Did anybody want to add to it before the last question? Okay, great. So the last question?
It's not really a question. This is my comment here. Okay. I've thought about this a lot because I was an engineer and then I left it entirely and just became a historian. But I'm interested in that world. I'm always interested in this idea that there are engineers as just like a singular. And this world that I study of Western water politics of the early 20th century, the rivalries between engineers. It's a political context. It's a business. They have business interests. This is the kind of thing that I think drops out of just this idea that, well, you learn, maybe it's a one best way or there's a few, but engineering is embedded in this political economy. Mm-hmm. And that's, you get out and you get a job with a business or a contracting company, and that's what you have to learn about. And then that's the thing that I think is probably the most important, mm-hmm. at least from my perspective, what I want to bring to the students that come into my history class, is a way in that you can talk about those things. That if you get out there, you have to understand that, well, it's like today, trying to deal with infrastructure. If you can't recognize the inherent politics of this or persuade that this is key. I also find it's easier sometimes to talk about it in a historical context, mm-hmm. because somehow it's more distant. Sometimes we have better sources because mm-hmm. you get things become available that aren't in the here and now. But to get them to be thinking about how, you know, there isn't just one way of doing engineering. There are rivalries. Mm-hmm. And my final point on this, it has to do with the regulatory state. You know, I've been studying this. The St. Francis Dam disaster killed 400 people. You know, it sort of dropped out. The politics of how that had to be dealt with by the engineering community in terms of the state legislature. And this issue that we are right now embedded in, I think, is the regulatory state.
Great.
And how so much is controlled and how we grapple with that. And that's the kind of thing to you bring. That is not so much an engineering issue, mm-hmm. but just sort of life.
Fantastic.
So anyway, that's my comment.
Perfect. And then, John, did you want to make a very quick comment to close the panel?
Quick. it cuts me to the quick when I heard Joe say and then Chris talk about these examples of people who are no longer engineers. Would an MD who became CEO of a hospital say, I'm no longer a doctor? Engineer is not someone who sits in a cubicle and designs stuff, right? So we have this profession. We need to think about the profession. I'm an engineer. Today I may be in sales. Next year I may be designing a plant in Ireland. We've got to change what we think of as the profession of engineering.
Great, good, fantastic. And I hope the next panel will pick up on that. Can you all join me in thanking our roundtable participants?